From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, shifting political sands in Oakland County.
It had this identity as this place of a lot of country club Republicans, a lot of wealthy business class Republicans. Over time, we've seen that type of group begun to sort of be alienated from the Republican Party.
Also, climate change and Michigan's birds. Sure, you'd expect migration patterns to change in warmer times, but what about birds' actual bodies?
It is better in a warmer environment to have a smaller body. It could be that at some level, these birds are able to keep pace with some aspects of climate change.
And the arid conditions in much of the state create a greater risk of wildfire earlier in the season than normal.
There was actually a severe drought from north of Kalamazoo up to Grand Rapids and then towards over Saginaw Bay area. We haven't seen that these conditions in quite a while.
These stories and more coming up. First, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on the program, we'll talk with Zach Stanton of Politico about the shifting tectonic plates in Oakland County politics. That's coming up in the second half of the hour. But first, we've been getting decent rain the past couple of weeks in southeast Michigan. Quite the storm last night. But there are large swaths of the state experiencing drought or drought-like conditions. This is particularly hard on agriculturalists during the most fertile time of the year, but it also poses an increased risk of wildfire. Here to fill us in on the conditions and where they're most dangerous is Paul Rogers with Michigan's Department of Natural Resources. Hey, Paul, welcome to Stateside.
Good morning. Thank you.
So there was rain in the forecast for much of west and northern Michigan over the weekend. Did those forecasts come mercifully true?
In some areas, yes. We did receive, especially in southwest Michigan, some areas received almost 2 to 4 inches of rain. Most areas received half an inch to an inch, which will significantly help in the short term. So we did get some rain.
That's good. Farmers can tell you, though, one day of rain, maybe even a weekend of rain, might not be enough to sustain crops. Paul, is just a bit of rain like that enough to get plants and trees watered enough to lower the threat of our forest fires?
Where it mainly will lower the threat currently is in what we call the fine fuels, which are your grasses, pine needles, leaves from last year. We consider those one-hour fuels. So it significantly will help and set back fires in those fuels. But again, they're considered 1 hours, and given the right wind and the right humidity and the right temperature, within 1 hour, those fuels can dry out and start burning again. So where we were having some problems, and some of this rain will help, because like I said, some areas got a couple of inches, are what we call the trees that are dead and down in the woods. The larger fuels, those are really becoming an issue for us. When we do have a fire, the old stumps, it's taking many, many days to mop those fires up where the stumps are burning way down into the ground. So we're seeing that already. And it is posing a significant problem. It will help set the danger back somewhat for 3 to 4 days. So we'll see what comes after this.
What are the geographic areas of greatest concern to you right now?
We have seen an area, again, this was alleviated a little bit, but there was actually a severe drought from north of Kalamazoo up to Grand Rapids and then towards over Saginaw Bay area. It wasn't a severe drought. We haven't seen that these conditions in quite a while. Overall, the eastern UP, northern lower Michigan is also a concern. They are abnormally dry for this time of year. Normally this is a fairly moist time of year. So, and this is the time we kind of start drying out in early to mid-July. So we are about a month ahead of schedule for where we should be.
Wildfires, of course, can be a natural part of a forest life cycle and even an important part of it. In the modern era, though, what do you count among the key starters of forest fires? Are most of them set off by lightning strikes, or are we firmly in the era where they're human-caused?
Oh, firmly human-caused. Over 90% of our fires are human-caused. And of those, the highest percentage, basically 99%, is debris burning. And it's not debris burning like what you normally think. Debris burning when people go up to their cabins up north and they clean their yards, even homes that are out in what we call the urban interface, where they're raking the grass and then they burn those materials off. Those are our largest escapes every year.
Mm-hmm. There are an awful lot of people out there in the woods in Michigan who are maybe taking their first outings in like a year. Do you think that people are in a different headspace when it comes to fire safety and the things that in another year they might spend, you know, spend some time and energy to do?
Most people have been pretty proactive. Where we have been seeing some starts are where people leave their campsites and their fires are not fully out. But most people have been pretty diligent about keeping their fires under control and just not burning when we say the conditions aren't right.
Yeah. What do you recommend when folks, if folks are in a place where they're at a campsite, what do you recommend in terms of fire prevention?
At a minimum, to make sure you have a ring for your campfire, preferably a metal or concrete ring. Most all park areas have those, but have it contained inside of that. And the biggest thing we tell people, have water nearby. If you're camping remotely, take a 5-gallon bucket with you and just have it sitting next to the fire. You can quickly extinguish it rather than all of a sudden it getting out. Then you have to scramble and find your stuff. If you have a cabin or a home and it has a standard water supply, either a well or city water, make sure you have a hose all set up with water in it and make sure it's working before you start burning. Those two simple things, or a shovel or a rake where you can quickly tamp out or throw some dirt on a fire, is a huge help, because once they start, it's very hard to get them under control.
Right. Paul, we're just a couple of weeks away from the 4th of July. It seems like all the additional travel and outings during these big weekends would probably increase our fire risk. Is that your experience?
Yeah, we will be seeing an increased risk. And again, of course, it all depends on the weather. But yes, we're watching that very closely. We're really cautioning people because it is the 4th of July and, you know, they're going to have the fireworks. Make sure you just don't randomly shoot the fireworks off into the woods. We get a few starts from those every year, and make sure that you're watching closely the area where you're launching them. Make sure it's all wet down, because they throw a lot of sparks when they first take off.
having indulged a bit myself over the years, I'm trying to, how do you not fire them off into the woods? Do you mean just find a big open space where there aren't a lot of trees around?
Correct. Find an open space where the grasses are not very long. You can watch and see what happens to them, and just have on someone keep an eye. If they do happen to go misguided and go off into the woods, have someone looking. And before you go to bed at night, make sure a couple of people walk out through the woods to make sure nothing has started after you do light off the fireworks.
Yeah. When we think about the wildfires that are natural to Michigan, what do those fires do that for a forest that cannot be accomplished by any other means?
There's many benefits to the prescribed burns that we call them, and the wildfires that would happen naturally. One of the biggest is the release of nutrients. It opens up the soil bank. So the native seeds, because many Michigan plants, especially in southern Michigan, are what we call the fire adapted ecosystems from hundreds of years ago. And they need it. They really need those nutrients to be released. And it's a huge benefit for them. So the other thing it does is the invasive species, it really sets those back. Many invasive species cannot tolerate fire, and that helps eliminate them and take care of that. The big one that we use a lot for up north is, especially in the Jack Pine area, a lot of conifer species, their pines are actually what we call serotonous, and they need fire to be opened up. They have to have a certain amount of heat before they're open to release their seeds. So it's part of the natural process where a fire will come through, and even though it looks devastated, it actually has released all the seeds back into the natural seed bank.
It bears repeating, though, that the human-caused fires have vastly outstripped the natural fire systems that Michigan's forests have relied on. We also know that the climate change of recent years is making forests hotter and burning longer. I mean, you hear a lot about this on the West Coast. California and Oregon have experienced some very serious fire seasons lately. What are you noticing here in Michigan? Has there been any effect?
Not really so much here in Michigan. We haven't seen that much of an effect yet. Us and the Forest Service actually have a very active prescribed burn program where we try and do as much burning as we can in the spring to bring that natural fire back in. And we do look at areas too where there's a high concentration of heavy fuels versus local communities, where we'll put fuel breaks in and do project work like that. So we try and protect it the best we can.
So, Paul, if I'm downstate and I'm coming up north to see some family or have some fun this summer, what do you recommend?
If you are going to burn, make sure your local municipalities allow it and double check with see if they are even issuing permits. A lot of communities don't, just because of high density of populations. If you are traveling north and going to enjoy northern Michigan, please make sure you check our burn permit site, and that will give you the conditions or whether or not it's safe to burn. Michigan.gov/burn permits.
Paul Rogers is with Michigan's Department of Natural Resources. Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you.
During the 19th century, the Pierre Marquette and Ann Arbor Railroads crossed in Thompsonville at the Diamond Crossing. This connection was crucial to the development of Thompsonville, as well as the rest of northern Lower Michigan. A historical marker was recently dedicated in its honor. Interlochen Public Radio's Kendra Carr has more.
There was a time when railroads were the way that most everything got around. A portion of rail that connected Frankfort to Toledo and the Traverse City area to Chicago is called the Diamond Crossing. That's because of the way the two railroads create a diamond shape in the center of the crossing. Last Saturday, the Michigan History Center recognized it with a historical marker. Dr. Charles Krause is the researcher that put together the application for the marker.
Like many things that happened with the railroads came to a place and suddenly something sprouted, a village sprouted.
And what sprouted from the Diamond Crossing was the village of Thompsonville.
Before the Diamond Crossing existed, there was no village of Thompsonville.
From raw materials to manufactured goods and people, everything moved via an intricate web of rail lines.
If you read the early newspaper clippings about Thompsonville, it was one of the fastest growing communities in the north, in this northwest area of Michigan. And there were articles about Thompsonville's going to become the county seat, Thompsonville's going to be bigger than Traverse City, you know, because it was just expanding very rapidly.
The tracks were used until the 1980s, when the railroad service ended. Dr. Krause heard about the Thompsonville Junction from a Benzie Area Historical Society tour. When he went looking for the railroad tracks, the Diamond Crossing was covered in weeds.
I almost tripped over it, and the actual rails of the Diamond Crossing are there. They're not in the position where they were when it was functioning as a rail crossing. They've been moved. And I began to think, well, somebody must have thought this was pretty important to save it.
That was what led him to ask the Michigan History Center for the historical marker.
That steel diamond is the last remaining bit of the Thompsonville Junction era.
You can find the Diamond Crossing historical marker on Thompson Avenue next to the Red Caboose and the Betsy Valley Trailway in Thompsonville. I'm Kendra Carr.
We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Bear. Birds have been around on this planet for so long and have adapted in thousands of ways, going all the way back to when their evolutionary lines split off from what would become dinosaurs. Birds are still changing, even as their numbers dwindle in Michigan. University of Michigan researchers have published a new paper that delivers striking news about birds and how they've been shaped by Michigan's climate. We've got two members of the team with us now. Marketa Zimova is an evolutionary biologist and a lead researcher on the paper. And Ben Winger is also an evolutionary biologist, an ornithologist, and a senior author on the study. It appears in the Journal of Animal Ecology. Marketa, Ben, it's nice to have you.
Thanks for having us.
Studies have shown us that birds are migrating earlier in the springtime over the past few years. Let's start with this. Marketa, is there anything you can tell us about why that's happening?
Sure, yeah. So we've been seeing across the world, actually, that birds are advancing their migrations in the spring. And the main cause for it is for them to avoid this mistiming with falls in food resources. So basically, because of climate change, it's a lot warmer earlier in the spring, and so the plants come out earlier, and their main food, which in our case are caterpillars, are out earlier. So in order to keep up with these seasonal changes, they are now leaving their wintering grounds earlier to arrive on their breeding grounds early in the spring to the end of the sentence.
Right. So when we do talk about climate change, it's maybe not so much whether it makes the birds comfortable or uncomfortable, but whether or not they can survive based on finding food, right?
Sure, and to reproduce. So yeah, they do need this major pulse of food in order to feed their nestlings.
Can you give us some examples of specific species and how climate change might be affecting their migration?
Yeah. So sure, this study mainly focused on songbirds. So a lot of the familiar migrants that actually come through Michigan every spring and fall. Our study took place in Chicago, but a lot of the same birds are found in Michigan. And so an example would be some of our early migrating sparrows, like the white-throated sparrow, or early migrating thrushes, like the hermit thrush. And we studied these birds that show up early in the spring. And we also studied birds that migrate much longer distances and that we don't see at these latitudes until a bit later in the spring. And that would be like the Swainson's thrush or some of our warblers that migrate much longer distances to winter in the tropics. And we generally found that the species that spend the winter closer to Chicago or closer to Michigan are changing the timing of their migration a little bit more than species that spend the winter further away in the tropics.
Can you tell us about how you went about collecting data for the paper?
Yeah, these data are from building collisions of birds or birds that have collided with buildings in Chicago and have been picked up by lots of volunteers over the past 4 decades. And these volunteers are people who are trying to understand why birds collide with buildings and how to prevent it. And the specimens from these dead birds made their way to the Field Museum, the Natural History Museum in Chicago. And over the past 4 decades, they've accumulated an enormous number of these bird specimens from building collisions. And so we've used these collision data to study a variety of things, from how the birds are changing in their morphology, their size and their shape, to better understanding why these collisions are happening in the first place. But in this paper, we were actually able to see the signature of changing migration patterns just based on the dates when the species collided with buildings and how that changed over the 4-decade course of the study.
I have a question about the method of collection, but first let's learn more about what you actually found. Marchetta, what does the research tell us? What did you learn from the data set about how the size and shape of birds are changing?
So we previously looked at this in a different paper that was led by one of the senior authors on this paper, Brian Weeks. And we found that overall, these 52 species of birds are shifting dramatically in their morphology. So they are decreasing their body size while simultaneously they're increasing their wing lengths over the past 40 years.
Do you have any early theories on why bodies might be getting shorter and wings might be getting longer?
Oh, yes, we do. Definitely. So that previous paper actually did describe what might be driving these shifts. So we did find that for the body size, it is reducing due to the warmer temperatures at their breeding ground. So it is actually better to have a smaller body just because you can lose heat more effectively. The increases in wing length, this is something that we continue to study, but this early study also showed that there is a link between the decreasing body size and increasing wing length. So we hypothesize, or we did find some supporting evidence, that in order to compensate for smaller bodies, they are increasing their wing length just so they can maintain these long migrations, because longer wings are basically improve flight efficiency.
The way that evolutionary changes happen has to do with many generations, as we saw with Darwin's finches, and variants in a bird's body type or structure repeating themselves in the specimens that tend to do very well at reproducing themselves, right?
Correct, yes. Except one thing, we do find that evolution can happen a lot faster than we previously expected. And even in the Darwin finches, things can, or birds and other animals can evolve quite rapidly.
What is the pace of this change? I mean, can we say that these generations of birds with smaller bodies and longer wing lengths are truly becoming dominant?
Sure. So essentially, the population is responding to the environment. And so the birds that are smaller and longer winged, we don't know. There's a couple different ways that the populations could be changing by evolution. One way is that they could be surviving better, that they could actually have reduced mortality. Or another way is that they just have better reproductive success, that is, they produce more offspring. And so we don't know, based on these data, which one of those things is happening more, whether it's better reproduction in the birds that are smaller and longer winged, or reduced mortality. But it seems that over these four decades, we are seeing a signature of change. And so that's the main thing we're focusing on. There are other possibilities, which is that the birds, the populations aren't changing in the classic way we think about with evolution, which is the sort of rise in dominance of one phenotype, but rather that they are changing in their development. So if you think about how the conditions in which animals develop when they're early in life can influence their size, it's possible that the size of these birds is being influenced also by their development, and it's not as much this evolutionary change that we see across generations. Either of those things could be happening, both of those things could be happening at once, and it's going to require different kinds of data to be able to tease that apart.
If you're just joining us today, my guests are Ben Winger and Marketa Zimova. They're part of a team of scientists who just published on Michigan's birds and climate change in The Journey of Animal Ecology. It was so interesting that of the 50-some species that you studied, there was not really a direct correlation between how much the birds had physically changed and how much earlier they began migrating. Ben, I think this kind of speaks to the possible factors that you just listed for us. But were either of you surprised by that fact?
Yeah, I think that we know from other studies that bird migration phenology is changing. So there are many other studies in which birds have been shown to be migrating earlier and earlier across years in the spring. And so it's kind of natural to hypothesize that maybe these changes in bird size and shape that we saw could have something to do with these changes in migration timing. We didn't find that. And so I think what's happening is that there's something more universal that is affecting all of these, the size and shape of all of these different species that doesn't have much to do with their migration timing, but could have more to do with what it's like to be a bird in general in this really rapidly changing environment.
Yeah. Ben, I know that you have been studying migration and bird collisions as they relate to each other. Could you explain a little bit about how this relates to this research?
Sure. So the data that went into this research is actually from a rather unfortunate source, which is that birds collide with buildings during their migration quite a lot. We see this throughout Michigan, particularly in the larger cities. The data in this study were from Chicago, which experiences a lot of bird migration and also a lot of mortality. And the main reason is that many of these buildings have their lights on at night, whether it's office windows that are illuminating the building from the inside, or lights on the outside of a building. And these migratory birds mostly migrate at night, and they're attracted to these artificial lights, and they then collide with the buildings. And so it's a big problem in many cities across North America and throughout the world. Essentially lots of birds die, and our research is trying to then use these specimens to learn something about the birds while also learning how to reduce these collisions. And so in another recent study, we were able to use the pattern of when birds collided at night throughout their migrations at one of the buildings in Chicago, and connect that to when the building had the lights on and what the weather patterns were to really show in detail when it is that birds collide with these lighted buildings and how turning the lights off either throughout the whole migratory period or at certain times can really reduce these collisions.
This has to be maybe the most unusual variety of specimen collection I've ever heard of for a scientific study. I guess I'm kind of glad that while bird collisions are causing huge problems for bird populations, that they are yielding some information. I did wonder, though, does data that we get from bird collisions, does that select for a certain kind of bird that's maybe more likely to fly into a building in Chicago, Illinois?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are some species that don't fly into buildings as much. Some of these are a little bit surprising. So we do see lots of, so for the bird watchers out there, we see lots of warblers and thrushes and sparrows that collide with these buildings, but we see almost none of another kind of migratory bird that's really common, and that's vireos. And so in all this research we're doing, we know essentially nothing about how these changes are happening in vireos because that data isn't available. I do think that, you know, while it's possible that different birds might be more likely to fly into buildings, I think it's pretty unlikely that the buildings themselves could be producing the patterns that we see. That is, this changing body size, I think, because these birds are coming from populations that are really large, it's more likely that the specimens that we're seeing are representative of a larger sample.
Do we know anything about why one species of bird is likely to fly into a building and why another is not?
The major divide has to do with when they migrate. So whether a bird migrates at night versus during the day. And so certain species like blackbirds, for example, they mainly migrate, blackbirds and swallows, they would mainly migrate during the day. Those species are less likely to be colliding in large numbers in an urban setting simply because they can see a little bit better what's going on during the day. Whereas the birds that are migrating at night are really the ones that are most prone to building collisions. Hmm.
You know, we kind of skipped over a point that I guess might be kind of important. This shift in the migration patterns of birds coming to Michigan, what does it mean for these bird species and for their larger and for the ecosystems that they're involved with?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I will say, aside from our research, it's really important to know that these birds, their populations are declining rapidly. So we know that North America has lost something like 30% of its avifauna, of its number of birds in recent decades. And so regardless of what shrinking birds means, I just want to drive home the point that these many of these bird populations are suffering. Now, whether shrinking in size is bad for a bird or whether it's indicative of an adaptation to the current climate, that's something we don't really know yet. As Marquetta said, it is better in a warmer environment to have a smaller body. And so it could be that at some level, these birds are able to keep pace with some aspects of climate change, but whether they're really doing so enough to produce as many young as they would have 40 or 50 years ago, we don't know that from our data alone.
Marquetta, what struck you most about this data set as you went through it?
Definitely in this study and in the previous study, that those shifts are just so widespread. Again, we have so many species and they're all doing the same thing. And then the other thing is that those two shifts are completely decoupled. Most of the time we are able to study one aspect of animal biology or ecology and how is it changing in response to climate change. But really with this data set, we were able to look at both of them and see how they interact. And we did have some good reasons to think that they would, just because bird morphology is really designed for efficient flight, and we did not find them. So I think it was just really shocking finding.
Yeah. Ben, I know that there are ways that the public can help with the research that you're doing. Can you explain what it is that you need people to do if they find or see a bird that's collided with a building?
Sure. Well, I think one of the best ways is to, particularly if you live in one of Michigan's larger cities, is to get involved in a local bird collision monitoring effort, which is sometimes headed by the local Audubon Society, or what's called a lights out initiative, which is to get local municipalities to turn their lights off. At the University of Michigan Museum of Zoology, we can receive these migratory birds that have collided with buildings and prepare them as specimens. And so the main thing is to put it in your freezer with in a plastic bag, but it's really better to get in touch with one of your local Audubon societies to know how to learn the best way to do that before the bird makes its way to a museum.
Marketa Zimova and Ben Winger are both evolutionary biologists at the University of Michigan. Ben's also an ornithologist. And Marketa is the lead researcher and Ben the senior author of this new study that can be found online. Marketa, Ben, it's really been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, April. It's been great.
Yeah, thanks so much.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A great deal of Michigan history has been interpreted as a seesaw of power between the urban powerhouse cities and the suburbs where a privileged few aspired to live. Oakland County in southeast Michigan is doing a radical rewrite of that script. For decades, a Republican enclave for white people of means, Oakland's exploding population and economic base have paved the way for a shift to the left, even as the county's GOP leans hard right. Michigan native Zach Stanton is a deputy editor at Politico, and he's just written a profile of the county that goes deep into past and present. Zach, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, there may be folks hearing us today in other parts of the state or even other parts of the country who aren't really aware of Oakland County's identity and history, especially with respect to Detroit. How do you describe Oakland County to people who aren't from around here?
So that's a question that I asked pretty much everyone I interviewed for this piece, in part because, you know, I grew up in Macomb County and I had a pretty clear idea in my mind of what Oakland was. And you know, I was born in the mid-80s, but growing up in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, you know, Oakland always had a certain sense of swagger. It was a very wealthy county. It still is, but it was one of the wealthiest counties in the United States. It's a very large county. It has about 1.2 million residents, and it has a mix of just really densely populated suburbs in the inner ring outside of Detroit, as well as some really wealthy small towns and developments in Bloomfield, Birmingham, Troy, and then also a lot of just like small lakefront towns and some rural populations here and there in between. But it's undergone a tremendous boom over the last, you know, 50 years or so. And some of that initially was because of white flight out of Detroit before the 67 riots even. And a lot of it in most recent decades, a lot of the growth has been as a result of huge economic growth in the county, much of it taking place in the high tech industry, in the medical industry, and all of that has really transformed the politics of the county.
Part of what makes the sea change in Oakland County politics so interesting is, as you point out, this is Mitt Romney country. This is where Ronna Romney McDaniel, the chair of the U.S. Republican Party, grew up. And it's now effectively in Democratic hands, although on a margin that's not conceivably irreversible. Can you recap what election results looked like in Oakland County over the past three or four presidential contests?
So one of the interesting things that's happened in Oakland County is that starting in 1996, it began to vote for Democratic presidential candidates. It voted for Bill Clinton, voted for Al Gore in 2000, very narrowly for John Kerry in 2004. But, you know, Obama won it twice. Even when Romney was running in 2012, Hillary Clinton carried it, and then Joe Biden carried it by a tremendous margin in 2020. But what has happened over the last couple decades is that whereas you used to have the situation where Oakland County would vote for a Democratic presidential candidate, it would still reelect like Brooks Patterson, who was the very powerful Republican county executive. It would reelect Republicans down the ticket. And what has changed is that you've begun to have Democrats win these down ticket races. And that has really transformed the county. It is, as you noted, this place that was once this quintessential Republican stronghold, as one of the people I interviewed described it. It was the place where George Romney moved his family in the 50s, where Mitt Romney grew up, where several generations of the Romney family have lived. And it had this identity as this place of a lot of country club Republicans. It's always a bit more complicated than that, but a lot of country club Republicans, a lot of wealthy business class Republicans. And over time, you've seen that type of group begun to sort of be alienated from the Republican Party, particularly in the Trump era, which was kind of a tipping point, where you began to see them just feel that the party doesn't really speak to their interests anymore in quite the same way. They aren't seeing themselves in sort of the Trumpian culture war dynamic that has been going on for the last few years. And Democrats have really been quite successful at making gains all the way down the ticket in Oakland.
The story provides a really illuminating recap of the rise and career of the late Brooks Patterson, as you mentioned, all-powerful county executive for many, many years in Oakland County, a guy who was just a master at turning culture wars to his advantage, but who also lived long enough to find some other gears and reemerge as a sort of more middle-of-the-road pro-business Republican who was just like, let's just get things done. Was there anything you learned about Brooks Patterson writing this story that you didn't already know?
There is so much about Brooks Patterson. The story that I published for Politico this past week was about 9,000 words. The first draft that I filed was more than twice that long. And I would say all of the words that were cut were mostly about Brooks Patterson.
Zach, you are an editor's nightmare. Let me just say.
I am. I chose my editor very carefully on this one. He was very polite, but said, Zach, there's no way we're publishing 20,000 words on Oakland County, which I understand. Brooks was such a larger than life character. You know, he was impossible to miss if you grew up or lived in Metro Detroit's media market for, you know, 5 decades, pretty much. And what I had known about him, of course, was that he got his start with some of the anti-busing movement in the 70s. But the real depth of it, I had been unaware of. You know, the National Action Group, which was this organization that he was the lead attorney for, was started in Pontiac by a woman named Irene McCabe as a reaction to this ruling from Judge Damon Keith that was going to force busing within Pontiac schools in order to integrate elementary schools, which were, generally speaking, segregated. And Brooks, who fairly recently had been fired from the prosecutor's office, he was in his early 30s, really hopped on board this, initially seeing it just as a way basically to pay the bills. Like he saw this PTA-style group of all these concerned white parents and thought, you know, these are people who are going to need wills written and are going to need legal help on this, that, or the other. And so it was a way basically for him to get clients. But it became this sort of crusade that really, you know, catapulted him to the front pages of newspapers across the country. And I had been unaware of things like him having meetings in the Nixon White House with Irene McCabe and John Ehrlichman, or, you know, all the national media coverage that he got in the 70s because of it. I was aware of some of the local coverage, but he was really a national figure in some ways. And I spoke with a historian at Dartmouth who's an expert on busing and has studied this. And he's cited NAG, the National Action Group, as kind of this turning point in the way that we talked about busing as a country, and that Brooks was really able to manipulate the media to understand what made a good sort of packaged story for the media. And NAG, which was predominantly led by housewives in the Pontiac area, really provided just this great visual contrast for people. It was a great story in many ways. And so when you had this at one point 620-mile-long march from Pontiac to D.C., you know, it was something that ultimately culminated in a rally in Washington, D.C., that didn't have great turnout. They only had about 1,000 people show up.
Wow.
But all the way along the entire march, it got huge and huge amounts of coverage. And so it was this really tremendous return on investment. It was a media success, even if it wasn't a protest success, if that makes sense. And
yeah,
what you see from that is Brooks just having this tremendous ability to understand how to get media attention, to understand when to be outlandish, to understand what it takes to really package a debate in a way that is to your advantage as a politician.
And this was at a point when Oakland was really defining itself as a sort of opposition voice to Detroit and yes. And a class of Black elected politicians that were coming into prominence in Detroit. It's really stark. I mean, looking back on Brooks Patterson's years in Oakland County or the way things changed after his death, are there some lessons there that the GOP or maybe anybody wanting to win in Oakland County needs to pay attention to?
I think one of those lessons is that, you know, the city versus suburbs type talking point just doesn't have the same salience it used to. For a long time, it was to both sides' advantage, really. I mean, you saw this in the fights between Brooks Patterson and Coleman Young, who was, of course, the first Black mayor of Detroit, where each of them, they sort of traded barbs in the media. It was sort of a headline war between the two. And both could be outlandish, and both understood how to get attention for their outlandishness. And that worked to their political advantage, but it really didn't work to the advantage of the region. You had a very clear divide between the city and suburbs. And what you've seen, certainly in the last few years, is those divisions just don't really make sense to a lot of people in Oakland or in Macomb or in Detroit anymore, where they don't bear animosity. People in the suburbs generally don't hate the city of Detroit. They have affection for it now. And so you're seeing, because of that, real shifts in all sorts of attitudes on all sorts of issues, things like transit, things like, you know, even the M1 rail. You, for a long time, had a lack of consensus about whether or not it was even important to try and redevelop downtown Detroit. I mean, Brooks famously in the 80s, among the many kind of outrageous things he said, you know, if I never had to cross 8 Mile again in my life, I'd be fine. Detroit doesn't mean a damn to me anymore. Mm-hmm. And you can't imagine a major suburban politician talking in the same way nowadays because people just don't think that way anymore.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking today with Zach Stanton. His latest profile in Politico is about Oakland County. It's titled with a quote from the story, "As long as the party embraces Trump, it's going to have trouble." At the same time, there are Republicans in Oakland County and Republicans who've been successful. Mm-hmm. Could you tell a little bit about what you observed, the Republicans who have been able to hold on in Oakland County, what they do and how they feel about the National Party's direction?
So Oakland, I should note, as part of Brooks's ability to attract economic development to the county, has really had a demographic transformation in some ways. And a lot of that has come as a result of the emphasis that he put on attracting highly skilled jobs, and attracting college graduates, and attracting the medical and life sciences industries to Oakland County. And you've had a huge influx of immigrants to Oakland County. You've had a huge influx of people in particular of Indian American descent, Chinese American, Korean American, and that has affected the demographic makeups of some areas that were traditionally Republican, places like Troy, which, you know, you think of Troy, you may think of like the Somerset Collection or, you know, right, sort of these swanky suburbs. But Troy in 2020 was, you know, just as Democratic in terms of the statewide vote, delivered just as many votes to Democrats as the city of Flint. And that's a different way of thinking about it. And so what you've seen is real success on the part of some Republicans who've been able to adapt to that demographic change really well. I spoke with Senator Jim Runstead, who represents, among other parts of Oakland, the Novi area, which has had a similar influx of Indian American people. And he talked about, you know, one of the things he's done is frankly just like show up and talk to people. And, you know, he's talked about going to Bollywood dance-offs and things like that that are in his district to just communicate to the people that are there that are part of these communities that I see you, you're part of this community, I value you. And he really spoke with frustration at the direction that much of the party is headed in, which is just not even showing up for these things. And in his eyes, you know, a lot of the things that particularly the Indian American community was interested in are things that are traditional Republican values. But if we're not showing up, he said, then it's logical that they're not going to vote for us, you know, and we need to at the very least show up. And increasingly what you're seeing is, you know, a national party that is headed in a direction that isn't as embracing of diversity as perhaps the local party would like, or perhaps even parts of the national party would like. I mean, famously after the 2012 election, the RNC commissioned an autopsy to understand what happened. and what the Republican Party should do to become more competitive nationally. And one of the things they advised was to bring in a more diverse coalition of voters. And then 4 years later, Trump got elected doing very much the opposite of that. And so you have this debate and this identity crisis going on within the GOP over what the right approach is, both from an ideological point of view, but then also from a strategic point of view. And you're seeing that play out in places like Oakland.
Well, at the same time, Republican strategists have said to you, among others, that, you know, what's happening may not be what the Republican Party has looked like, but it is working in places like California, in places mm-hmm. like Florida. I mean, is it possible that what's happening isn't that the Republican Party has turned away from Oakland County, but, you know, because of the siren song of Trump, but maybe because places like Oakland County are not as important nationally anymore?
I mean, that is the argument that some people make, is that you do simultaneously have, as Oakland County has moved further into the Democratic column, you do have places like Macomb County that have moved further into the Republican column, or places even like Genesee County, which have become more battlegrounds than they traditionally have been. But the other way to think of it is that these vast, wealthy suburbs of places like Oakland, affluent suburbs, are places that they really need votes, not only for presidential elections, but for congressional elections. Oakland County has parts of four U.S. House seats in it, and all four are Democrats now. Just a decade ago, two of those four were Republican seats. And so if Republicans want to take back the House, whether it's in Michigan or elsewhere around the country, they do need to compete in some of these battleground suburbs. And if they're not making the inroads that they need to, then that's really going to set them back as they try to retake Congress.
Yeah. You note that there are a number of down-ballot races that have gone the way of Democratic candidates, especially Democratic women. And you profile candidates like Marie Manoogian and Mallory McMorrow, who've come into their own in the state legislature. But overall, it feels like the change that's happened here has been on the right. What happened in Oakland County's Republican Party after January 6th? Can you give us any signposts for which way the county party is trending?
Yeah, so it's difficult to separate the end of the Trump era from kind of the end of the Brooks-Patterson era. You know, Brooks died of cancer in 2019. And since then, you've begun to see a real vacuum in the Republican Party in Oakland County. And as a result of that, there's been just sort of a default to Trumpism. And people who were on the very Trumpy side of the party have been able to go to great heights now. One of the people you've seen is Michonne Maddock, who is now the co-chair of the state Republican Party, but, you know, had been the chair of the Republican Party in the 11th Congressional District and is on the executive board of the Oakland County Party. You know, she was someone who organized buses to take people from Oakland to Washington, D.C. for the Trump rally that became the riot and insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. And a month later, less than a month later, frankly, she was elected co-chair of the Michigan Republican Party. So what you're seeing a lot of the time in the Republican Party, whether it's in Oakland or throughout the country, is just this inability to have an identity separate from Donald Trump. And that is, on the one hand, good for Donald Trump, perhaps, but on the other hand, is not great for a lot of Republicans down ticket, because they are already having a hard time carving out a place for themselves. Every politician kind of is, when we have local media in many places kind of dry up. And that prevents local candidates from making an independent identity for themselves. And it just makes everything sort of filter through the lens of the national media. And so if everyone is basically just judged vis-a-vis Trump, that is going to be hard for a lot of Republicans who may not be where Trump is, who may be more moderate and may have different views about things like diversity and may not speak in the same way that he does. It makes it more difficult for them to carve out their own niche. And that is a problem in places like Oakland County, for sure.
Zach Stanton is a deputy editor at Politico. You can read last Friday's story titled, "As Long as the Party Embraces Trump, It's Going to Have Trouble," at Politico's website. Zach, it's always great talking to you. Thanks for this article. I learned a lot.
Thanks so much. My pleasure.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Big thanks to everyone who helped fill in last week. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.